If you slept, you missed it. Another government shutdown.
Both parties, the establishment, want to spend more money.
Domestic violence allegations rock the White House.
The pictures, I think, were too much for this White House to bear and to defend.
The president wants a big, beautiful military parade, but D.C. leaders say tanks but no tanks.
Trump has authoritarian tendencies. It's not a surprise that he wants to do what other authoritarians have done.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. There was some talk in D.C. this week about sensible shoe wear. Why? Because of the 4-inch heels on the feet of 77-year-old House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi as she stood and talked on the House floor for over 8 hours on Wednesday.
And we feel helpless. That's what the hard part is. Helpless if our speaker will not, a speaker of the whole House, will not give this dignity to this House of Representatives to be able to take a vote on a subject of broad debate in the country, but we can't debate a bill on the floor of the House.
Pelosi, the former House Speaker, was demanding action on an immigration bill, one to protect Dreamers, young immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children, from deportation. The day after, Republican Speaker Paul Ryan had a hat tip.
I don't know if I could have hacked that for 8 hours. So it was pretty darn impressive. You're right. And she wasn't wearing these kinds of shoes. I would have gone to the bathroom well before then, I got to tell you.
I'm told there's a saying about Ginger Rogers dancing just as well as Fred Astaire, but backwards and in heels. And by the end of this week, everyone's stamina, including mine, as you can hear from my voice this week, and shoes of choice on Capitol Hill, it was all tested as Congress again failed to beat the clock. Of course, if you got a full night's sleep Thursday into Friday, you missed it all, the second government shutdown of the year. Once again, Congress missed a midnight deadline, but this time the lapse in government funding was essentially non-existent as lawmakers, both in heels and flats, pulled an all-nighter to eventually pass a massive budget that busts spending caps, known as sequestration, prompting another talk-a-thon from Senator Rand Paul. More on him in a moment. The budget package sets the stage for 2 years of budget harmony on Capitol Hill. The deal also secures the key Democratic demand, a debate on immigration. That will begin initially in the Senate on Monday afternoon.
While I obviously cannot guarantee any outcome, let alone supermajority support, I can ensure the process is fair to all sides.
Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell promises no parliamentary games. He says next week's debate will be a freewheeling amendment process with multiple proposals offered and voted on. The first to get 60 votes is the winner.
We just don't know where 60 votes are for any particular proposal, and so we're going to find out.
Speaker Ryan also says he has every intention of giving floor time to an immigration debate.
I know that there is a real commitment to solving the DACA challenge in both political parties. That's a commitment that I share. To anyone who doubts my intention to solve this problem and bring up a DACA and immigration reform bill, do not. We will bring a solution to the floor, one that the president will sign.
It's that last part from Speaker Ryan about a bill the president will sign that has many Democrats and immigration advocates uneasy. They believe President Trump's demands for a border wall and new limits to legal immigration through family-based chain migration and the visa lottery go too far. In the Senate, McConnell's promise is simple. The first proposal to get the required bipartisan support advances. Negotiators are suggesting it could be a smaller package than the four-pillar approach preferred by the president. McConnell's offer was intended in part to separate the immigration issue from a must-pass spending bill and avoid another government shutdown like the 3-day shutdown last month. It didn't work. The government did shut down, albeit for fewer than 9 hours. But immigration wasn't the issue this time. It was spending and debt and a protest by Kentucky Republican Rand Paul.
Now it's Republicans in charge, busting all the spending caps. The Democrats are complicit. Both parties, the establishment, want to spend more money.
In order to fast-track a vote in the Senate, you need agreement from all 100 senators. It's called unanimous consent.
We should have a full amendment process. We've been open for business 10 hours today. You can do 4 amendments an hour. We could have done 40 amendments. So it's a canard to say we can't have one amendment and can't spend 15 minutes debating whether or not it's good for the country to add $1 trillion in debt. So, Madam President, I object.
Several times, Republican leaders asked for that consent to move quickly onto the budget bill. Each time, Senator Paul objected. He says because of the lack of debate over a two-year agreement that ends automatic spending cuts known as sequestration and okays $400 billion in new spending for both the Pentagon and non-defense domestic programs. For leaders in both parties, it was a good deal, a compromise, boosting the military, long sought by Republican defense hawks, and eliminating spending cuts for social programs, a goal of Democrats.
The senator from Kentucky, by objecting to the unanimous consent request, will effectively shut down the federal government for no real reason.
Number two, Senate Republican John Cornyn's harsh words for his Republican colleague. After all, the votes were there to eventually pass the compromise measure, whether it happened early in the evening or early in the morning. Paul held out. A few minutes before 2 a.m., senators approved the plan, 71-28. Before 6 a.m., a bipartisan vote in the House. And at 8:39 a.m., President Trump tweeted he'd signed the bill, officially ending the overnight government shutdown. The idea is to set aside this sort of dance that happens in Congress every few weeks, these temporary stopgap spending bills. The measure technically only funds government through March 23rd, so lawmakers will face a deadline to actually appropriate or dole out that federal funding to government agencies. But the two-year agreement does solve a major step in that process, how much money is actually available for both the Pentagon and the rest of government. One other bit of song and dance was also set aside by the plan, the debt limit, which was expected to be breached in a matter of weeks, is now suspended or raised until March of next year. Rob Porter probably wasn't a known name in most households and still may not be, but domestic violence allegations against Porter have set off a scandal at the White House this week. It led to his abrupt departure and has raised questions about who knew what when and how well the White House is vetting employees. For that and everything else this week at the West Wing, we bring in John Decker, our White House correspondent.
Who is Rob Porter? What was his job at the White House?
Rob Porter's last day at the White House was on Thursday. He served as staff secretary to the president, a very important job in any White House. They are essentially the chief of staff to the chief of staff. They are in charge of making certain whatever the president sees on a daily basis in terms of paper. He's in charge of making certain that the president sees certain things and doesn't see certain things. He's the gatekeeper. And as a result, he played a very important role in the Trump White House, often traveled with the president, both domestically and abroad. But these allegations, which came up this week, of spousal abuse, including some pictures which raised a lot of eyebrows, led to his abrupt resignation.
There are questions about how soon, how long ago the White House, at least some people at the White House, were made aware of these allegations. What do we know about the timeline here?
Well, we know that because Mr. Porter served in such a high-level position, he had to go undergo a background check. He would be perhaps looking at items which are essentially very top secret and are classified. As a result, the FBI needs to conduct a background investigation. And as part of that background investigation, the FBI spoke to two of Rob Porter's ex-wives, both of them detailing allegations of spousal abuse. And one of them showed pictures of a black eye that she says she received at the hands of Mr. Porter. Another of his former wives, his second wife, says that she obtained a restraining order against Mr. Porter. Mr. Porter denies this. Despite that, the pictures, I think, were too much for this White House to bear and to defend. And even though he resigned, he was expected to stay on in his position until a new person was tapped to serve in the role of staff secretary. He would essentially help in the transition. But the pictures were too much to bear, Jared, and he was asked to leave immediately, clear out his desk yesterday on Thursday, and he no longer is at the White House.
So you mentioned that Rob Porter has strongly denied these allegations. In fact, President Trump said as much when he was asked Friday afternoon by reporters about Rob Porter. Here's what President Trump said.
It was very sad when we heard about it, and certainly he's also very sad. Now, he also, as you probably know, he says he's innocent. And I think you have to remember that. He said very strongly yesterday that he's innocent. So you'll have to talk to him about that. But we absolutely wish him well. Did a very good job while he was at the White House.
So, John, it sounds like had it not been for this photograph, Rob Porter may still be employed at the White House despite this separate investigation going on.
I think that's very true. I mean, you look at the statement that was initially released by the White House Chief of Staff, General John Kelly. It really didn't address these allegations which were being made by Rob Porter's ex-wives. But the pictures come out, and they were broadcast mainstream media, all the 24-hour cable channels. And two more statements had to be put out by the White House Chief of Staff. And ultimately, they said, you cannot remain in your role here at the White House. And his resignation was accepted. He no longer is here at the White House.
Deputy Press Secretary Raj Shah spent a lot of time talking about this on Thursday and conceded at one point that this situation may have not been handled the best way.
The allegations made against Rob Porter, as we understand them, involve incidents long before he joined the White House. Therefore, they are best evaluated through the background check process. It's important to remember that Rob Porter has repeatedly denied these allegations and done so publicly. That doesn't change how serious and disturbing these allegations are.
What we know is that there is an FBI background check, as we mentioned. That's brought to the White House counsel's office, and the White House counsel is a gentleman by the name of Don McGahn. So he has this information in his possession. And followed up, asked Rob Porter about the allegations which were made by his two ex-wives. And he told Don McGahn, it's not true. And Don McGahn accepted that, moved on, and Rob Porter, up until these photographs were released, held on to his position. But once the photos were released, that changed everything. And as Raj Shah said yesterday, he was subbing in for Sarah Sanders, who is on vacation. The White House could have done a much better job in terms of how it handled the FBI background check information that was presented to it as they went about deciding whether or not to first hire Rob Porter and then keep Rob Porter in his position.
It is important to point out as well that in addition to the denial from Mr. Porter, White House staff has been very supportive of him. They say that he exhibited no signs of any of this behavior.
And that's what, you know, Rob Porter's ex-wives say, that professionally, he's top-notch. He is one person in terms of his public persona. He is a different person, according to his ex-wives, in his private life. And I take them at their word. I have nothing to discount anything that they're saying. And obviously, the White House, to a certain extent, believes these two ex-wives as well. That's the reason why he's no longer at the White House.
You know, one of the things that we've learned a lot about, at least those of us who don't know a lot about, you know, the day-to-day sort of background checks and classification levels at the White House, is that a lot of people, maybe more people than we thought at the White House, are working under what's called a temporary clearance. What does that mean? What's behind that? And does that mean that there are still details about other White House staffers that may be out there?
Well, this is not the first White House to have this issue regarding background checks and individuals in very high level positions, perhaps being unable to obtain those types of clearances. I can recall, Jared, for instance, in the Clinton White House, very high level Clinton aides being unable to receive the type of clearances that we're talking about because maybe times have changed, but because of past marijuana use. That was problematic for the FBI back then. That prevented various high-level aides from getting those types of clearances. Things have changed. You know, I don't know if they take things as seriously at the FBI with that kind of background as it relates to marijuana use, but this is pretty serious stuff, and this is when we're talking about spousal abuse. That's the reason why the FBI brought this to the attention of the White House counsel, and ultimately it's the White House counsel's decision to either go with what the FBI is recommending or suggesting, or to discount it. And it was quite clear, Jared, that they essentially discounted it. And that's the reason why Rob Porter was hired and retained this position.
So there's been a lot reported as well this week on Rob Porter's relationship with John Kelly, the two very close, a lot of trust between these two. What's been the White House's response to some of the criticism that's been leveled on the chief of staff, John Kelly, through all of this?
Well, John Kelly is the White House chief of staff, brought on, I believe, on July the 31st to serve as the chief of staff, replacing Reince Priebus. He's a person who's brought a lot of more discipline and order to the White House, and he counted on Rob Porter to sometimes carry out his directives. So there was a lot of trust that he had in Rob Porter. But even though John Kelly may also have been aware of these allegations that were made against Rob Porter, he too initially decided not to remove him from his position after he found out about these allegations of domestic abuse.
Again, the game changer, the White House would say, for the chief of staff was, again, these photos being published that you've spoken about.
That was a game changer. Initially, the story was broken by the Daily Mail Online. So, you know, some people would say that's sort of a tabloidy type of website. But the mainstream media picked this up. Fox News picked this up. And when Fox News is, which is in some quarters very sympathetic to the Trump White House, is running these stories almost on an hourly basis, I think that just becomes too much for the Trump White House to defend this individual. The White House is a lot bigger than one individual. The White House is a lot bigger than Rob Porter. And when all of this is brought to bear, they'd rather just part ways with Rob Porter. And that's exactly what they did.
Sounds like this is a big role as well that's going to have to be filled from a personnel standpoint.
It is indeed. This is the kind of role where you need to get a buy-in from lots of people, including not only White House Chief of Staff General John Kelly, who will work arm in glove, hand in glove, I should say, with the new person who's hired to be the staff secretary, but also the president himself. As we mentioned, this particular individual who's hired for this role will work very closely with the president, often travel with the president. So it's not a position which you can simply, you know, put a one ad for. You need to do a lot of vetting, and I don't know how soon the White House may be able to fill this particular position.
John Decker, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week.
When word got out this week about President Trump's vision for a grand military parade, it didn't take long for people to start making comparisons to displays of military might from North Korea, China, and the old Soviet Union. Some even tweeted pictures of goose-stepping Nazis. It appears the president became enamored with military parades during the Bastille Day celebration in France.
One of the greatest parades I've ever seen. We may do something like that on July 4th in Washington, down Pennsylvania. I don't know. We're going to have to try and top it. But we had a lot of planes going over. We had a lot of military might. And it was really a beautiful thing to see.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis confirmed the Pentagon is drawing up plans.
I think we're all aware in this country of the president's affection and respect for the military. We've been putting together some options. We'll send them up to the White House for a decision.
Are military parades only for totalitarian states?
Get ready for the Jubilee.
They've been done before in the United States, but usually they're tied to the end of an armed conflict, all the way back to the Civil War. In 1991, the end of the Persian Gulf War was celebrated in a victory parade down Constitution Avenue in Washington. The event included thousands of troops, tanks, tactical trucks, and...
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Patriot missile. Twenty-seven Patriot missile batteries were deployed to the Middle East, including four batteries to Israel, two to Turkey. out of 53 possible targets in their engagement
area. The Patriot
area.
Missile, which was instrumental in the quick, decisive victory. President George H.W. Bush and First Lady Barbara Bush were in the review stands. Attendance was less than expected for the event, which cost around $12 million. The 1991 parade was the largest public display of military might since the celebration marking the end of World War II.
This is the jump off. This is Operation Homecoming, the last official mission of the All-American 82nd Airborne Division. Their objective, the 4.5-mile parade route through New York City.
Now, the Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden, Robert O'Neill, tweeted that the military parade idea is third world BS, adding, "We prepare, we deter, we fight. Stop this conversation." Democratic Congressman Ted Lieu says a military parade would be a waste of taxpayer money.
Trump has authoritarian tendencies. It's not a surprise that he wants to do what other authoritarians have done, such as have great big military parades to help stroke his own ego. I would rather have them plan for a better strategy in Syria. We're going to have military members who have to train to go march in a parade. It is just a complete waste of resources. We should be spending this on real-world problems.
But others say the parade will show appreciation and respect to the nation's men and women in uniform. Even some Democrats think a parade would be a good way to honor our veterans. Jesse Jane Duff is a retired Marine gunnery sergeant and senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research. Her opinion of the parade? Bring it on. As a military veteran, how do you feel about the president's idea for a military parade?
I'm excited by it. I think it's invigorating. The last parade that I recall was when I was on active duty. I was a baby Marine at the time, not to reveal my age too much, but it was 1991. And many of our forces had come into Washington, D.C. and paraded down Pennsylvania Avenue. Some of my contacts were in that parade. And yes, a lot of active duty military will tell you, we don't want to do a parade, we don't want to do a parade, because they do parades all the time. But our parades are to celebrate for the American people. It gives them an opportunity to cheer and feel rejoiced and to feel success on our mission, our accomplishments, and show support. And all my contacts that I remember talking to at the time said their sentiments fully were invigorated when they went down Pennsylvania Avenue, because they heard those cheers, they heard people yell, "Welcome home," and that is something our Vietnam veterans never ever experienced. Patriotism should never go out of style.
It's usually the case, though, that these kinds of military might displays are reserved for victory celebrations. You mentioned the Gulf War celebration in 1991, marking the victory there. And I was looking back at some of the footage. I mean, they had all kinds of things. They had tanks. They had the Patriot missile rolling down Constitution Avenue. So it's been done before.
Yes, the left has turned this into something, trying to compare it to North Korea, China, or Russia. When we start, you know, I find this ironic. Do you hate Donald Trump more than you love your military? First of all, our parades are nothing like a communist parade. Let's not even try to meld the two together, because when we're celebrating those heroes who come home, we're going to hopefully bring in the troops that actually were part of the units that had done the most collateral damage to defeat the enemy. So all of these Marines, soldiers, airmen, and sailors who have been on these lines, who have fought so hard, why not celebrate them? Why not let them? It's a great recruiting tool, too. We don't celebrate our military enough. We turn it into something that's negative and compare it to communism or a society that deprives their people of their rights.
I have to ask you this, because you mentioned the divisions among veterans and not everyone's on the same page. The Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden, Robert O'Neill, tweeted that this is third world BS. Do you have a response to that?
Well, we all have opinion, and it wasn't third world BS when we did it for Desert Storm. Why would we now say celebrating the military is third world? I think it's really disingenuous to suggest that President Trump is a third world dictator. I think it's insincere to suggest that he is any resemblance of anyone, any other leader other than ours. And, you know, we're trying to make something very good and celebratory into something bad. I think for active duty military, myself included, we have to remember when we do our parades, it really isn't for us. It's for the people. And when we stop remembering our customs and courtesies in this country, then we've lost a big part of our patriotism. If we're going to go and say that's third world BS, then why do we have the military in the inauguration parade? And I can appreciate Rob's initial feelings and maybe his gut reaction, but let's take a step back and think. people want to say thank you. And it's to recognize those who could not come home. Vietnam vets always felt that they were spit on. Let's not spit. Let's clap. Let's cheer.
Meanwhile, officials in the nation's capital are not happy about the idea of hosting such a large-scale and expensive event. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser's office has said if the president wants the parade, he'll have to pay for it. The D.C. City Council sent out some cheeky tweets. One said the giant tank parade is canceled permanently. Another, tanks but no tanks. No date is set, but for now, the Pentagon is under marching orders to make the president's big, beautiful parade a reality.
If the stock market were a theme park roller coaster, this week you'd have to be pretty tall to get on the ride. The Dow fell about 10% from its year high, including a more than 1,100-point plunge one day alone. It got me thinking, is Wall Street worried about what's happening in D.C., or should D.C. be worried about what's happening on Wall Street? For answers to those questions and others, I cornered Fox Business Network's Adam Shapiro.
As we watch the markets do what they do, and it's been a bad week on Wall Street, how much does that have to do with what's happening here in Washington? You know, the new tax bill, the very short-lived government shutdown, a lot of start and stop with spending bills. There's a new Fed chairman. Is any of that have anything to do with what's happening up north on Wall Street?
Sure, a little bit of it, but it's never one thing, and you can't— You can rarely point to one specific issue that drives the market. But what you said earlier when you were asking about this really betrays the problem, which is you said, as we watch what markets do, markets haven't been real for several years. This up and down in the market, although we're seeing big swings right now, haven't happened. And it's because we've had artificially low interest rates, which have kind of leveled the playing field for people so that they really haven't had to take any risk. So the market, when we say the market, we're talking about the Dow, has run up tremendously. So in 1987, when we sold off more than 500 points, we fell 23% roughly. That was a huge drop in one day. Today, we lose 1,175 points, as happened earlier in the week, and it's roughly a 4.6% drop. So things get blown out of proportion based on the size of the index at this point. But the other issue is that what we're rediscovering, because we haven't seen it for about 10 years, is what they call volatility. And that's where we're at.
So I guess the question is, does Wall Street react to what's happening in Washington? Or
yes.
Is Washington going to have to react to what's happening on Wall Street? In other words, is the Fed going to have to take action here?
Okay, so it's funny you should say that, because I was standing in front of the Federal Reserve the day that we had the first big 1,000-point-plus sell-off. And I was asked that question because it was also the day that Jerome Powell, Jay Powell, was sworn in as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve. Something to know about the Federal Reserve.
Tough first day, by the way.
It was his tough first day, but keep in mind, he's been there for quite a while. He's been a member of the Board of Governors for a couple of years, so The Fed watches all of this, but what makes the Fed effective at what it does is they don't react the way you and I or other investors react. There are people running around with their hair on fire, and they might be justified in doing that, selling in some, or buying, whatever. It's kind of like that scene, if you've ever seen the movie Trading Places, when they're trading the orange futures, and
right.
Get back in there, Mortimer, sell. But the bottom line is the Fed does not react that way. The Fed watches everything very closely. And if the Fed were to determine that what it was watching, not just in the stock market, but in other areas, created some kind of risk, then the Fed might consider stepping in a way to prevent a problem. But they're very slow to do that because just because the market is reacting in a certain way doesn't mean, for instance, that liquidity or cash is freezing up. So they're looking at a much bigger picture than those of us who are running around with our hair on fire. So the answer to your question is the Fed would do something if the Fed thought it was necessary to do something. But don't expect, because you got a sell-off on the stock market, that the Fed is going, oh, we have to do something, because they're not.
Congress has locked in now this two-year budget agreement, a long time coming, the goal of which is to try and set aside these continuing resolutions that fund government weeks and weeks at a time. This will do it sort of fiscal years at a time, the way it's supposed to work.
Is that good news for Wall Street, or does Wall Street not really care?
Okay, so there are several issues you've just talked about. Wall Street does care about stability. So first, keep in mind, all Congress did was kick the can down the road to March 23rd. They raised the spending caps. It would be like if you have a son or daughter with an allowance, the son or the daughter just voted to raise their allowance from $1 a week to $10 a week. But now the son or daughter has to negotiate with the bank, mom or dad, to get the extra money. So they raised the spending caps and they kicked the appropriations down the road, but they still have to negotiate that. So we could be having a crazy moment on the 22nd of March. But the thing that's driving the market, what the market's looking at right now, and it's part of what you're seeing in the sell-off, is the U.S. government is no question going to be borrowing in the next 10 years. Imagine Dr. Evil from the Austin Powers movies. $1 trillion. I'm raising my pinky as I say it. Between $1 and $2 trillion to keep the lights on. All right? That's a huge amount of money that we're adding to an already $20 trillion debt. And the market's looking at that, and they're different markets. The bond market is very upset with this because, first, in order to get people to buy the future debt, the government's going to have to raise what they call the coupon. The interest rate's going to be a little bit higher. And so that's going to start having an impact that could raise interest rates. And then the stock market's looking at that and saying, well, if easy money, because interest rates are going up, isn't going to be quite as cheap, you know, I'm not going to perhaps be able to sell this stock today, this is the fear, to somebody tomorrow as easily. In fact, I'm going to have to be looking at real returns on this stock as opposed to just the fact that the money was easy to borrow and then to buy it. So that's all in play right now. And people are trying to figure out where to protect themselves and where to go. And so the fact that the government's going to be borrowing trillions of dollars is raising interest rates, which is upsetting the stock market. And on top of that, the Federal Reserve has already indicated that they intend most likely to raise interest rates 3 times this year. There are bank presidents at the Federal Reserve who are talking about raising interest rates 4 times this year. There are others who are saying, no, we should keep it at 2. But all of that is in play. And that's the fuel that is setting everyone's hair on fire. I keep using that expression because that's what this is. This is just people never make good decisions when they are freaking out. But can we talk in English about this?
I mean,
like your 401k. That I understand because I invest in a 401k. Right. I don't buy individual stock because I'm a financial reporter and it would compromise the company. I can't cover Ford, which I love, by the way. I love cars. I wanted to buy Ford stock, but how could I cover Ford if I own their stock? So what I do is I buy an index fund. I've done this since my very first 401k, probably before you were born. And that index fund is very simple. Warren Buffett, not me, Warren Buffett says to people like you and me, you should buy an index fund and call it a day. Because if your company matches and you're buying an index fund like the S&P 500, the Vanguard Index 500, the Fidelity Spartan 500, they mimic the S&P 500. Your return over the last 20 years is pretty good. You've beaten most of the hedge fund geniuses on Wall Street, actually. So slow and steady wins the race. So when you asked me earlier about 401ks, I am not happy that my 401k, like your 401k, especially if it's following an index, which mine does, has fallen greater than 10% in just 1 week. That makes my stomach turn. But I'm young enough to know that that's going to come back. When we fell in 2008, almost 40% between 2008 and 2009, from the top of the market to the bottom of the market, that's enough to make your 401k go screaming and running home looking for cover. A lot of people said, I better get out. Well, the people who said, I better get out, missed the incredible upswing we've had since 2009. And, you know, the market is up dramatically since its bottom. And I forget the actual date of the bottom. So that's why long and steady wins the race. If you are under 60 years of age, you have time.
I think what's confusing, at least it confused me, is this tax bill passed late last year.
Yes.
Market really seemed to respond to it. The president has talked about this record growth, this record pace of the stock exchange. And then over the last, what was it, this week or last week, that started to show up in many folks' paychecks. Why did the market not respond to that in the way that the market responded to the initial passage of this tax law?
The stock market had already priced in the tax reform before you started seeing the extra, in some cases, 10, 20 bucks in your paycheck. So stock market was already pricing that in, and consumer spending was already maxed out at the end of last year. And we are maxed out right now. If you look at some of the debt levels that we're incurring once again and what people are doing, the extra $20 to $30 in your paycheck may not be enough to cover it. So the stock market is very happy with the tax reform bill, but it priced it in last year, not this year.
And we will leave it at that. Thank you for making sense of what has been quite the pendulum to watch on Wall Street this week.
Ah, sell!
Thanks, Adam.
That will do it from the From Washington podcast this week. A long-awaited immigration debate kicks off next week. DACA, the wall, chain migration, visa lottery, all of it expected to be part of a number of proposals from several different groups of lawmakers. President Trump will also release his budget plan to Congress. Expect that to trigger a new round of fiscal fighting. And of course, there's the ongoing Russia investigation, the dueling congressional memos about the FBI. So much can happen between now and our next podcast. So the best way to stay up to date is our top of the hour newscast, either right on your radio or the Fox News Radio app or Amazon's Alexa, Apple Siri, and Google Play. All of them will play it for you. Just ask for Fox News or your favorite Fox News Radio podcast like this one from Washington or the Fox News Rundown. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.